I'm Leonard Lope. Welcome to my show. It's been a half century since Joseph Papp started presenting Shakespeare to New Yorkers for free, and in the process, he introduced a whole new brand of theater to our city. Millions of New Yorkers, as you know, are grateful. This Monday night, there's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime musical celebration of its anniversary, and joining me now to pay tribute to the past and look at the future are the wonderful Rosie Perez and Oscar Eustace, the Public's new artistic director. Welcome to our show. Hi.
Hi. Thanks.
Hello.
Oscar, when was the first Joseph Papp free performance done?
1955. 50 years ago.
Any given day? It had to be in a warmer time of year.
I'm sure it was. I don't have the day right on the top of my head, but it's, you know, it was a brilliant idea, and now it seems natural, almost as natural as the air we breathe. But it was so radical, man, just the idea that we're going to take the greatest writer in Western history and make him the property of the people for nothing. Just give him to the people.
What in the public parks.
In the public parks.
Now, he had to deal with Robert Moses, didn't he?
And he dealt with Robert Moses more successfully than almost anybody else. He fought Robert Moses and beat him. And interesting, what is often not remembered is Moses was trying to stop Joe from performing in the park, but specifically he was trying to force him to charge admission. And the whole battle was over the principle that it had to stay free. And Joe won that battle.
Why did Moses want to charge money? So that he could pay for the soil erosion that he was so worried about?
That's what he claimed. What we really believe, of course, is that he just wanted to keep control of everything. And there is something innately out of control about putting on theater for free in the park. It's wild, and that's what it's supposed to be.
Well, there was no Delacorte then. Where were these plays being performed?
Well, at that time, it was literally on the side of the Delacorte now, just on a makeshift platforms. But we started down on the Lower East Side Amphitheater.
Moved around town, didn't you? Wasn't it also down in Brooklyn and other parts?
Absolutely.
Of the city?
And that's actually a tradition that we are going to be reviving. It used to be called the Mobile Shakespeare. And Joe would put things on the back of a truck and drive it around and open up the flatbed. It's just
amazing.
Rosie,
do you remember when you saw your first free Shakespeare production?
Yes. We were so ghetto that we didn't understand that it was for free. So we decided to sneak in. Yeah, it's true. And we climbed up on the rocks.
Fantastic.
And the whole reason for it is because we heard that Raul Julia was going to perform, and that was such a big thing for us. We spoke about it before, Leonard.
Yeah.
And
was that Two Gentlemen of Verona?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And we didn't understand what the heck was going on, because we were all prepared to, we were little, we were really young, and we were all prepared to see the regular, you know, Shakespearean performance, and we see just everybody going crazy on the stage and dancing and discoing, and we're like, that's Shakespeare, you know. And but that was my first experience with Shakespeare in the park.
Well, you came for the stars.
We came for Raul Julia, yes.
Yeah.
We came for Raul Julia.
Do you remember your first time, Oscar?
The first time, I actually don't. It would have been in... No, I do. It was Henry V in the summer of 1976 that Joe directed, and you're going to ask me who played Henry, and I can't remember it.
But it's okay.
I'd actually...
It was Raul Julia.
It wasn't Raul. Raul was at the Beaumont doing Three Penny Opera. At that time, that was the first thing I saw of the Public Theater's productions, Raul's amazing performance in Richard Foreman's Three Penny Opera.
Well, you auditioned to appear in one of these things, didn't you, when you were an actor?
Leonard, are you going to
really?
Bring that up?
Oh,
it's
please,
bad. It's a bad moment.
Let's go there.
It was actually my last audition, Rosie, was for Joe. And it was actually for that production that I later saw in the park. Lee Brewer from Mabu Minds was directing the fight scenes, which seemed like a good idea to Joe at the time. And Lee, who was a friend, got me an audition. I was 16, 17 years old. And I came in and I did just an excruciatingly bad audition for Joe. And Joe was extremely polite. And I walked out of the room and I said, I'm not an actor. I've never auditioned again since that day. Turned myself into a director out of shame at my acting.
Well, Rosie, you have been a strong supporter of the public, but you've only really appeared in one production, isn't that true? 2001, and maybe the first time you ever were on this show for references to Salvador Dali, Make Me Hot.
That's correct. My first offer to appear at the public was Angels in America. George Wolfe asked me to come in and read for the part, and I was terrified, and I turned it down. Stupid me. I wasn't ready. I was just pure fear that stopped me from doing that. And then,
and that would have been a great experience because so many of those productions, the public theater productions, are workshopped, and you actually can develop a character in a way that you can't if you just hire to perform in something that's already been written.
Right. Well, I didn't understand that process, you know, because when you do movies, you audition and you have one table read and then you shoot. And so I was like, that could never, ever, ever happen. I'll fall on my face. And then once George and I developed a relationship, and he assured me that is not the theater process. And at the public theater, it was Joe Papp's tradition to take care of artists first. So we'll take care of you. And so that's why I decided to move forward, thank God. And and so then I did references to Salvador Dali, Make Me Hot.
And Rosie just out there promised me to do 10 more shows in the next 10 years. She signed a binding contract, so you'll see lots of her.
You no longer have to audition, Rosie. But you know, it's stunning just how many talented and now famous actors have passed through the public. Mm. The rock musical version of Two Gentlemen of Verona that you were talking about not only had Raul Julia, but also Jeff Goldblum, Jerry Stiller, and Starkad Channing.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
And Jeff Goldblum was cast as a spear carrier because they needed somebody really tall to stand in the back with a spear.
Now, we have a little clip in which Joseph Papp was asked how he got all those great actors.
Well, the situation here in New York is a very interesting one because it is the cultural center of the country and the theater center of the country. There are many, many actors available, unfortunately, but they're available for work. They have two problems. One is to make a living. The other is to keep themselves developed, to be able to work on particular material so that they can, as professionals, keep up their practice and so forth. And there has been a tremendous interest from an actor's point of view in Shakespeare recently, and particularly in plays that do make demands upon them in style and speech. There's no tradition for it in this country, not a very great tradition for it. It's usually been the English tradition. And we were looking for a kind of an American tradition. And as a result, I know many actors since I come from the theater myself, and I know people who know people who know people, and we made certain announcements in the various theatrical journals. And we interviewed some 200 actors, all told, and they all knew they were working for nothing, contributing their services. And we managed to get a number of people who spoke well, who had a sense of the style, some very experienced and some not so experienced. But they're all professional people who made their living in the theater.
And the list goes on and on. I mean, we had Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline appearing early on in their careers. In fact, Meryl Streep was in 8 shows in 5 seasons starting in 1975. Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah.
Linda Ronstadt made her theatrical debut.
Pirates
of Penzance. Pirates of Penzance. Yeah,
exactly.
I saw that.
And was that your first theatrical performance as well?
In Salvador Dali?
Yeah.
In Salvador Dali? Yes.
And that's when you fell in love with the stage.
That's when I fell in love. I mean, I had done the Vagina Monologues, but I wouldn't consider that in the same vein of theater acting. And so it was my first, and it just started me off, you know, and I fell in love. I felt that, you're right, we spoke about it before. It was the first time I fell in love with acting.
My guests are Rosie Perez and Oscar Eustace, who is now the artistic director of the Public Theater. He has just recently replaced George C. Wolfe. And we're talking.
Nobody replaces George C. Wolfe.
Well, we'll get into that later. We'll get into that later. The next in line, in a very distinguished group, you first Joe Papp himself, then Joan Acolytis, and then George C. Wolfe, and now you. They will be among the participants in the Public Sings, a 50th anniversary celebration, one night only event next Monday at 7:30 at the New York City Center at West 55th Street between 6th and 7th. And who's going to be there? I mean, you're going to be there, Rosie, right?
I'm going to be there. Just when we went, I saw you coming out of rehearsals. I saw Natalie Portman singing. And I was like, wow. It was Natalie Portman singing, and before her, Billy Porter.
Savion Glover, Eartha Kitt, Meryl Streep, Elaine Stritch. It's going to be an absolute Ben Stiller. I can't name everybody because it's going to be such an extraordinary, extraordinary group of performers.
And yours truly.
And what will you be doing?
Sing.
Sing.
From a chorus line.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to talk about chorus line in just a moment. Mm. But it turns out that we have this incredible audience that knows everything. And we are informed that Paul Rudd played.
Exactly. It was Paul Rudd. That's right.
No way.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So if you have any other questions about the history of the public theater, just
I've got to come on this show more often, Leonard. That is an impressive thing.
Meanwhile, let's talk about the chorus line. It's difficult to imagine a time before a chorus line hadn't been performed. It's one of the most successful musicals of all time. It wasn't even the first one that the public had done.
The public opened its building in 1967 with this odd tribal love rock musical called Hair. It was the first play other than Shakespeare that the New York Shakespeare Festival ever did.
Was it different? I don't remember whether there was nudity in the original production.
Actually, there was not nudity in the original production. But the songs and the book, the glorious chaos of the book and the songs were exactly the same. It was Hair. It was a perfect and brilliant transition, I think, for Joe, going from providing Shakespeare to the people to saying that now what we're going to do is we're going to add to the canon by taking from the streets and from our times new work that speaks to.
So that was really the first major break with Shakespeare or the classics?
Absolutely.
No Chekhov?
Nope.
And this is the first original production.
Shakespeare to Hair. Unbelievable, isn't it?
And then it went to Broadway, right?
It went to Broadway in 69. And Chorus Line, the thing that I love about Chorus Line is that it's exactly what Rosie was speaking about. It wasn't just that we did a very successful musical. It's that Michael Bennett, an artist that Joe believed in, had an idea that he didn't know exactly what to do with. And he came to Joe and said, I just want to sit around a table for a month with a bunch of dancers and talk and maybe do some workshop, maybe see if we can come up with something. Chorus Line was developed. And that development process is precisely what the public can provide and the theater can provide. It's not about churning out commodities. It's about letting artists breathe and letting life happen. And, of course, to a certain extent, Chorus Line revitalized not only the public theater but Broadway.
But both of those productions really changed an awful lot of stuff on Broadway. It changed, I would say, Hair pretty much changed our expectations of what a musical could be. A Chorus Line even more so because of the whole process.
Absolutely. And as George Wolfe points out, and it is sort of, I think, a brilliant insight about Chorus Line, is that one of the reasons that we responded it so powerfully is that it was in the middle of the 70s and it was about wanting to get a job. It wasn't just about the theater. It was about unemployment. It was about that slightly desperate tinge that New York had at that time.
Well, it's time to revive it, I think.
You bet.
My guests are Oscar Eustace, dramaturge, artistic director of the Public Theater, and Rosie Perez, and they are participating in the Public Sings, a 50th anniversary celebration, one-night-only event, this coming Monday at 7:30 at New York City Center. More about that and other things right after this.
When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter
Well, I'll tell you about the opening night. We had almost not gone on with the play because of all the problems, but finally, through some act of the Savior, we managed to get the thing ready. Well, it was about 7 o'clock, and I was backstage working the sound equipment, and I began to wonder if there an audience would ever appear, because some of these things that people had told me began to, well, enter into my mind, although I was very doubtful about it. Well, I waited till 7:30, and I looked out, and there at the gate was a mass of people. It seemed to me thousands of people just straining at those gates, ready to go in. And the doors opened, and down they came. They just rushed headlong into the theater and filled the theater completely, you know. It just took about, in 25 minutes, the place was completely filled. There were 2,000 people occupying their seats, and hundreds more outside waiting to get in.
What types were these people?
I think at the beginning that these people were mostly people from the community. I think the great majority of these people had never seen a legitimate play before. And I think they came a great deal out of curiosity more than anything else. Now, this was not the entire audience. There are numbers of housing projects in the community which cater to a kind of a middle-class group, and I think some of there were theatergoers amongst them. But on the whole, these were mostly people from the Lower East Side, and they were just curious to see what this Shakespeare stuff was around. Some woman thought Sid Caesar was going to appear, not Julius Caesar, and she asked that question. And she waited all night for Sid Caesar to appear, but he didn't come.
And how did they...
One singular sensation. Every little step she takes. One thrilling combination. Every move that she makes. One smile and suddenly nobody else will do. You know you'll never be lonely with you. No.
We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Public Theater 3 days in advance of the performance of The Public Sings, which is a one-night-only event, Monday night, January 30th at 7:30 at the New York City Center, West 55th Street, between 6th and 7th Avenues. If you're interested in inquiring about tickets, the number is 877-581-1212, or... if I said that too fast, you can find all the details on our show page at WNYC.org. So, Oscar, Robert Moses wanted Joe Papp to charge. How did he manage to finance this whole thing?
Well, the same way we've managed ever since, which is by getting people to support and underwrite the cost of it. Now, at that time, Joe wasn't paying actors. I'm happy to say we're paying actors now. We're not paying them enough. We can never pay them enough, but... it's an expensive proposition, and we have to find underwriting for it.
And he was doing it as a part-time job. He talked there about working the sound equipment on that
Absolutely.
First production. But he was working in television.
He was working as a stage manager for CBS, and he actually, part of this struggle, which is so interesting, is Moses red-baited him. As part of Moses red-baiting him, CBS fired him. He, through the union, sued CBS to get his job back. One, it was a very important moment in the breaking the grip of McCarthyism in this country, and the day he won, quit, never worked another job other than the New York Shakespeare Festival again.
But it was obvious that he remembered his roots. Is that one of the reasons he insisted on and bringing Shakespeare to the Lower East Side?
No question.
And to the public that he described in that wonderful clip from The Voice of America?
No question. It was Joe always claimed that he grew up in a Yiddish-speaking household and that he taught himself English by studying Shakespeare at the public library. And, of course, the public theater is in a public library, the old Astor Place Library, which was both the foundation of the New York public library system, the free public library, but it also that building served as the home for the Hebrew International Aid Society for 40 years. And so the previous uses of this building were freely disseminating culture and knowledge to the people and physically bringing in immigrants and integrating them into the life of the city. What could be a better building for us?
He also integrated the performances. There was, it didn't matter what a person looked like, what the race, color, creed, etc. The important thing was whether that person could act and act in this ensemble.
Yeah, I think that's one of the public theater's greatest legacy, because it gives an artist, regardless of your, like you said, race, color, creed, hope that you can achieve the heights of Broadway or off-Broadway, and the public theater will help and nurture you. And it is just all about talent, supporting talent.
When you think about sneaking into that first performance that you saw in 1975, I guess it was, to where you are now. I mean, I don't know how much you give credit to the public for the beginning of that, because at that time, I'm sure you had absolutely no thought of going into show business. You were a Marine. You were thinking of becoming a Marine biologist.
Yeah, that's correct. I had no aspirations as to going into the arts, although I loved to sing in the shower and I thought I sounded great. hence the song Sing from A Chorus Line. But I never, ever, ever imagined that I would be making my theatrical debut at the Public Theater. And also the other thing I think is the greatest legacy for me for the Public Theater is that we were speaking earlier off air, that it brought street politics to the stage. There have been political pieces of theater on Broadway and off Broadway prior to the Public Theater and Joe Papp, but not in the way that he did it. It was pure and it was honest, such as A Chorus Line. It was about unemployment. It was about desperation. It was about, you know, we were at war. Nobody was working. Everybody was starving. And then you fast forward to Angels in America. Nobody was talking about AIDS at that time. It was still taboo, but the streets were talking about it. The clubs were talking about it. But the politicians sure were not. The elite sure were not. And here you go, and you have Angels in America. And the same thing with...
Without Rosie Perez, unfortunately.
Without me! Oh, my God! What a tour de force it would have been! No, it was. But I think that's what's so wonderful. And you still have that prevalent today with the current plays at the Public Theater. It has not lost that spirit.
And then I think of some of the other productions of going beyond, like the all-African-American performance of The Cherry Orchard, or bringing the Three Penny Opera back in 1976-77 because it was a new translation.
Right, right.
That's now the standard by which Three Penny Opera is judged.
That's right, the Mannheim Willett. Or doing things like, you know, taking an extraordinary actress like Rosie Perez, who is also turning herself into an amazing writer, where she's got this incredible story, which I hope we'll figure out some way to work on at the theater with Rosie as a writer. That three-dimensionality of how we can embrace artists and give them possibilities is something that happens in the theater, can't happen anywhere else. It's a home for artists. It's not just a place to do your work.
And my guests are Oscar Eustace, who is the new dramaturge and artistic director of the Public Theater. He will be at New York City Center on Monday at 7:30, along with Rosie Perez and many of the other wonderful people who have performed at the Public over the many, well, now 50 years of its history. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. So, Rosie, in your case, you got this opportunity to appear at the Public, and then you wind up on Broadway in Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, and then Reckless. Mm-hmm. Was the taste of theater that you got at the Public what led you to want to do those other things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's still like when I get a screenplay sent to me, I'm like, you know, because I'm wishing that it was a play. Because of the process at the Public Theater of nurturing an actor and nurturing an artist, you really it's like a class that you go to. It's better than a class. And you start to really break down and understand your craft. And the interaction with me in an audience I never thought I would fall in love with. And once I got bitten, I wanted to be bitten again over and over and over and over and over. I loved it. It's undeniably one of the most exciting things I've ever experienced in life outside of the bedroom.
One of the, moving right along.
Look at Leonard. Sorry.
One of the interesting things about the building on Lafayette is that there are a number of theaters there. I don't know whether the actors get to talk to each other as they're performing. Is there any kind of
exchange? As much as possible. Part of the six different stages, Joe's Pub and five theaters at the Public. We just closed this last weekend, this amazing festival, Under the Radar and Global Fest, international theater and music, where we had 13 different musical acts, five different international theater companies, all performing at the same time over 4 days, turning up, going to see each other's work, running into each other in the lobby, sharing audiences. It's that Renaissance, calamitous combustion of audience and artists that also makes the big tent of the Public such an exciting place.
And the dressing room factor, too, that when you do a play at the Public, you must share dressing rooms with the other people that are in other plays.
So there's a democratizing aspect to this.
Yes, and you start to respect other performers and their space, and the whole diva element is removed. You're only a diva once you step on the stage, and that's a wonderful factor of the Public Theater. And just as when I was at the Public, there was Dog Eaters there, and there was another play there, and everybody's running around and getting ready and talking. How was your day? This and that, and stretching and preparing, and you just feel like one big family, and you create friendships that last a lifetime.
Now, Oscar, you've worked for theaters around America, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about theater dying, but it doesn't seem to die. In fact, if anything, this last year seemed to be something of a revival, at least of commercial theater.
Yeah, the theater isn't coming close to dying. What's our job, those of us who work in the theater, is just to consistently make sure that the theater is as connected to the life of society as it possibly can, because the only time the theater dies is when it separates from the people. And it is every great period of history when there's been an advance of democracy in the Greeks and the Elizabethans and the New Deal, there's been an explosion of theater at the same time. It's the most democratic medium there is.
What about the other parts of a production? Well, directors, for example. Were the artistic director at Trinity Rep in Providence, Rhode Island for a long time. And I'm sure you face some of the problems that you'll face here, trying to present people with things that they'll feel comfortable with at the same time that will challenge them.
Well, you hope not to make them comfortable. You hope to make them excited. And it's interesting. What I found, I've worked a lot of places. I lived in L.A. for years, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Rhode Island. And everywhere I've been, it feels like it's a similar process, which is you can't actually pick trying to guess what other people like. What you have to do is sink into the community, become as much a part of it as quickly as you can, and then program what you like.
But there's always the problem of money, isn't there? I mean, even off-Broadway productions now are incredibly expensive.
Sure, there's a problem of money, Leonard, but please name one place in this era of capitalist triumphalism in which money isn't a problem. That is unfortunately the era we've been born into, and we will struggle with it and do fine.
Is theater different in New York than in other cities?
Absolutely. It's much more central to the life of the city.
I guess only maybe Chicago and Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, not Los Angeles, I'm afraid, having fled from Los Angeles. Chicago is vital, but it's not like New York. New York is New York.
How much did, or how did Joanne Acolytis and then George C. Wolfe take the Public into new direction?
Well, Joanne came from an experimental theater background. She would start as an actress with Mabu Mines, and I think she really pushed the theater in continuing to embrace the downtown community around it. George accomplished many things, but the two that I'd point to is that he became the most successful conduit between the politics and culture of the Public and the commercial theater that we had ever had. He was extraordinarily facile at moving between those, and He made the public the first major theatrical institution in the United States that can't be called a white institution anymore. And that is an extraordinary achievement.
But he also seems to have made millions of friends. I was on a plane the other day, and sitting next to me was Tanya Pinkins of Carolina Change. And she, there was an article about George in the, I guess, the L.A. paper. And she got all excited. She said, oh, I've known George for so long. I love George. I love George. I love George. Here's what he did for me. Mm. And I know I've spoken to so many other people who talk about him this way as though their careers would not have been the same without George C. Wolfe's taking a chance on them, but also giving them a kind of support and confidence that they right. might not have had otherwise.
Well, George, the one main thing that George said to me that stuck with me and I use repeatedly, he said, Rosie, step into your greatness. Don't deny it. Step into it, because I don't have time for you not to. I don't have time for you to ignore it. So please step into it so we can move on. Wow. You know what I mean? I said, oh, my God. And then I was like, but I'm scared. He goes, oh, I'll be right here. And that's the thing. You know, you work with certain directors and you feel this bond with them. And as soon as the project is over, they drop you. And you feel so insecure and so abandoned. And, you know, that's the worst thing you could do to an actor. But with George, it's like even when he has a party at his house, you see the same familiar faces that you have seen at the public, whether they are part of the chorus line, whether they are PAs, ushers, actors, directors, lighting designers. Everybody is welcome. He takes care. And so it's not just what he does for you when you're working with him on a specific piece. It's what he does for you after the piece is over.
And I'm sure that you, Oscar, will continue that tradition. The Public Theater
yes.
will be presenting The Public Sings, a 50th anniversary celebration. At the New York City Center.
The City Center.
I forgot to mention James Lapine is directing.
The marvelous James Lapine.
And we have performances by Zach Braff, Savion Glover, Eartha Kitt, Idina Menzel, Donna Murphy, Mike Nichols, Natalie Portman, Ben Stiller, Meryl Streep, Rosie Perez, and many others. And people can get tickets by calling, what is the number? I had it here somewhere. Anyway, you can also just check our show page at WNYC.org. By the way, you'll find a link at our show page to Sarah Fischko's affectionate piece about Shakespeare in the Park. That's at WNYC.org. Thanks to both of you so much.
Thank
and we
you,
want
Leonard.
To thank Andy Lancet from WNYC's archives for those wonderful clips of Joseph Papp.
Thank you.
Long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, matty, oily, greasy, fleecy, shiny, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen, knotted, polka-dotted, twisted, beaded, braided, powdered, flowered, and